We've seen now some gospel references that give us some indication of what Pharisees appear to have believed. Jens Schroeder, professor of the Faculty of Theology at Humboldt University in Berlin, finds other indications. He notes that in the Gospel of Mark, the conflicts Jesus had with the Pharisees in Galilee all concerned questions of the law, while all of the conflicts he had with them in Jerusalem concerned questions of politics, chiefly taxes. This latter view accords with Josephus' account of the Pharisees being a politically active party. In Galilee, they watched Jesus eating with sinners and tax collectors. They criticized him and his disciples' disregard of fasting, Sabbath observance, and purity rules. They observe him healing in a synagogue on the Sabbath, and they involve him in a debate about divorce. In these conflicts, Schroeder says, Jesus insists that the law must be interpreted according to God's will, to welcome sinners, to exalt substance over form, to establish the primacy of marriage, whereas the Pharisees are presented as interested in a literal obedience to the law. They insist on the observance of the law, and they oppose Jesus for subordinating the law to his own presence and for even overruling certain regulations of the law. The Pharisees didn't like that, of course. And this coincides with Josephus' description that they are most skillful in the exact explication of the laws. Matthew presents the Pharisees as critics of the law concerning fasting, Sabbath observance, and food regulations. They are those from whom the kingdom will be taken away. They sit on Moses' seat. They wear broad phylacteries and long fringes. They observe the rule in tithing strictly, and they venerate the prophets and the righteous. But they are hypocrites because they don't practice what they preach, and they lay heavy burdens on others. They seek recognition from the people, and they forget the weightier matters of the law. This accords with the Essene negative characterization of them too. Some of the authors in the volume think that Matthew's broadsides against the Pharisees stem from his intent to disparage them after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And Father Meyer thinks this is plausible too, but he also points to an important historical truth before 70 AD. Quote, which Jewish group would Jesus most likely collide and debate with, if not the Pharisees? After all, according to Josephus, the Pharisees were the Jewish party most active and influential among the common people. He observes, it is hardly a wonder, then, that Jesus would have interacted more with them than with any other Jewish movement or party. While we're talking about negative characterizations in Matthew, let's talk about this, especially negative slur. Matthew records both John the Baptist and Jesus calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers. In Matthew chapter 3, John says this when he sees many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to him for baptism. You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? And then in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus himself uses the same words. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Now, this brood of vipers accusation is, shall we say, one hell of a pejorative. Calling someone an offspring of a viper was actually worse than calling one a viper. In antiquity, and even through medieval times, it was thought that newborn vipers ate their way out of their mother's stomachs and killed the mother. What a rich metaphor this was, because it insinuated that the Pharisees and Sadducees had eaten their way through their own covenant with God, just like the serpent in the Garden of Eden, and they were tempters who were trying to take away people from God. Whoa, as we should pause to say. That's a lot worse than being called some two-faced SOB, or even a hypocrite. To say someone was a baby viper was to say, you are a snake who eats your own mother. In point of fact, vipers do not actually eat their way out of their mother. They're born from eggs, but what makes them unusual among snakes is that they're hatched inside and then are birthed. But the metaphor still works, and you wouldn't want to be called one of them. And so, while we're at it, Let's now talk about the much ballyhooed woes Jesus throws at the Pharisees. And we should remind ourselves, as Father Meyer does, that these kinds of woes were, as he says, quote, quite typical of the defaming of adversaries' practices in the ancient Mediterranean world. It was especially typical, he says, of the ways various Jewish groups attacked one another around the turn of the era. In other words, readers of the gospel accounts back then would have found nothing out of turn in hearing the woes here. We might, by that same token, say that Jesus said these woes, knowing they were typical of the day too. And I think we can also rejoice with Father Meyer in taking at least one comfort of living in modern times, quote, polite ecumenical dialogue among different religious groups is a happy modern invention. So true. Here's the unvarnished account of the seven woes in full color. The first woe. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. Here's the second woe. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you traverse sea and land to make a single proselyte, and when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves. Here's the third woe, and it's the same one we talked about earlier, but in somewhat longer form, so you can now hopefully see what Jesus is talking about when he puts things this way. Woe to you blind guides who say, if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing, but if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing, but if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So he who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it, and he who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it, and he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. See his point? They are taking something most holy, the temple and the throne of God in heaven, and trading it for something less holy, gold. And don't think these Pharisees are the only ones in history who have made this unholy trade. His curse is just as applicable today, perhaps more so, given the supreme priority so many have placed on wealth. Here's the fourth woe. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done, without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. We don't have any rabbinic references to gnats or camels, but I'm sure we don't need any. His point is clear, and it at least shows that Pharisees were known for tithing on mint and dill and cumin. And Jesus wasn't saying they were wrong in doing so. The fifth woe touches on an issue that was raised in the rabbinic literature over 100 years later about the cleansing of cups. Jesus said this, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and of the plate, but inside they are full of extortion and rapacity. You blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and of the plate, that the outside also may be clean. Now, as we saw earlier, whether you needed to wash both the inside and the outside of a cup raised a legitimate issue under the Mosaic law. Jesus, though, goes way past that, as if he doesn't care one way or the other about the issue. His point is that we have to make ourselves pure on the inside. That's what counts. The sixth woe. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. The ossuaries, those chalkstone vessels sold at Zadok's and all other places around Judea, Yes, they were white and pretty on the outside, and they included dead things on the inside. Don't be like them, he says. They got the point. Seventh, and pay attention. We're going to hear about those vipers again. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, saying, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all this will come upon this generation. So we get his point, or we better. And we can't escape the fact that he's hurling these charges directly at the people standing in front of him. Do we really think that the Lord of the universe is not able to make these very personal charges against them? I mean, that's the whole point of all the Gospels, isn't it? That Jesus will come at the end of time and deliver judgment? And that judgment will entail very bad things for some people who deserve those very bad things. Some people will be sheep and will be put on the right, and some will be goats and will be put on the left. So for those goats who get put on the left and are sentenced to eternal punishment, why wouldn't Jesus, through these harsh warnings, not be giving them, shall we say, a preview of coming attractions? If judgment at the end involves bad things, why can't judgment before then foretell bad things? So please, let's stop saying there is no way Jesus actually ever said these things. And please don't commit blasphemy like Yale Divinity professors seem want to do by saying that, well, Jesus was only human when he said these things, and he somehow forgot what he said in his Sermon on the Mount. Was Jesus hurling all of these woes at all Pharisees and Sadducees not present there, but elsewhere? Well, why not, at least in general terms? What's wrong with him having made a generalization like that, especially if it were generally true? Who are all these pontifical biblical scholars to say it was not true, that it could not be true? Do they have any evidence of the hearts of these particular men? If so, let's hear it. And for those who say Jesus never even spoke these words, again, what evidence do they have for that? The words are certainly consistent with other words Jesus said. Father Henry Paramitattil, the Dean of Biblical Faculty at the Pontifical Biblical Institute, makes a stunning observation about something Jesus said elsewhere in the Gospel of Matthew. In chapter 12, the Pharisees ask Jesus to show him the sign of who he is. Notably, they don't ask for a sign from heaven, which is probably why they thought Jesus was casting out demons according to the power of Beelzebub and not from heaven. But note how Jesus answers them. He says this, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. Now we're all familiar with the connection to Jonah in the 3 days and nights in the belly of the fish and in the tomb. But pay attention to these other words Jesus uses. Nowhere else in all of Scripture will you find these words, evil and adulterous, used to describe the children of Israel, except in one place, in the book of Hosea, chapter 3. And in that passage, the prophet is describing them in exactly these terms. Jesus is calling the Pharisees evil and adulterous because they are evil. And they are whoring around with false gods. That's strong language. Jesus is dropping the near equivalent of an F-bomb on them. I'm sure if you were a Pharisee and you heard all these words, you'd most definitely want to kill him. I mean, I would, naturally speaking, that is. Wouldn't you? And the chief priests and leaders did kill him through the agency of Pontius Pilate. Don't you think, then, it's more plausible than not that Jesus actually said these words to them to give them a motive to kill him? Look, if I were a district attorney and I were prosecuting certain leading Pharisees for having killed Jesus, I most emphatically would be using these words of his to be powerful evidence of their motive to kill him. And let's not forget what other effect these words may have had on others. Others like Nicodemus. Perhaps, quite plausibly perhaps, there were some Pharisees who took Jesus' words under consideration. And in a quiet moment, maybe even in a quiet moment of reflection at night, and they decided Jesus was right. Yes, that Jesus was right. As a holy priest friend of mine used to say, sometimes you have to yell at people in order for them to hear you. Jesus was yelling, if not literally, at least figuratively. And maybe it took that yelling for some of them to actually hear him. Which is to say that, finally, they reflected on what they had heard. Is it too hard to imagine that some may have had this introspective? Damn it. Maybe he's right. Maybe I do shut out the kingdom of heaven against men. Maybe I really don't want others to go in. I guess it's true. All of those proselytes I've made are twice as much a child as hell as I am. I have been swearing by the gold of the temple lately. I really shouldn't be swearing at all. True, I do tithe on mint and dill and cumin, but am I neglecting the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith? Well, I certainly don't have much to defend myself against that. And yeah, what a stupid technical distinction I've been making about cleansing cups. Look, I buy the argument, but really, who am I kidding? And me, a whitewashed tomb? Yeah, I feel that way. I'm sick inside. I am a snake. I belong to a club of snakes. We would eat out our own mothers. I am angry. I am filled with rage. I rage against people all around me. I've been raging against this Yeshua fellow and all his stupid, ignorant followers. I'm not happy. There must be a better way to live. Maybe this Yeshua has a point. And our leaders have certainly killed other prophets throughout our nation's history, only to regret it later. Really regret it. Woe is me. Yes, woe is me. Now, don't you think it's possible, that some Pharisees somewhere heard these horribly personal accusations Jesus was saying about them and repented? Why would modern biblical scholars think that's not possible? Well, we do have one very prominent Pharisee who may not have heard these words directly, but he certainly heard them indirectly. Others certainly told him these words. And yes, the words filled him with murderous rage. He didn't get a chance to kill Jesus, but he got the chance to oversee the killing of one of Jesus' followers. And he let his people pile their cloaks at his feet when they went to stone him to death. And yes, the follower was Stephen. And the handy coat checker was, of course, Saul, the Pharisee. But we don't get a lot of help from this Pharisee, Saul, who was later named Paul, about what he believed as a Pharisee. The only thing we have from him on the subject is this one small sentence. Paul says that he was, quote, with respect to the law, a Pharisee, and with respect to righteousness in the law, blameless. That's in Philippians chapter 3. What does that mean, blameless? Scholars aren't sure, although they don't read Paul to be saying that he was believing anything evil or adulterous, or otherwise objectionable under the Mosaic law, or the oral traditions arising from it. He was a good party member who believed all the right things, taught all the right things blamelessly. That doesn't tell us what things he believed in, though, and so we're not much farther ahead in knowing what Pharisees actually taught and thought. Wouldn't it be great to know whether Paul had ever met Nicodemus? Whether it was Saul or Paul? Saul, the firebrand, blameless Pharisee. Nicodemus, the Pharisee traitor? Most likely, Saul would have had nothing to do with him, even if he had known of him. Until later. Did he, as Paul, ever meet Nicodemus later? After his return from Damascus? Did he look Nicodemus up and say, "Hey, is that true? Did you really meet Jesus at night? Did you really arrange for his burial? Do you now think he's the Messiah, like I do?" Oh, to have been a fly on that wall, to hear what they may have talked about long into the night. But we'll never know. So in the end, from all of this, we get a few insights about what may have been rumbling around in Nicodemus's mind. Issues about cups and gold and divorce and fasting and Sabbath and tithing and damages for poked out eyes. He had a sharp lawyer's mind about these things. On the one hand, he revered tradition. On the other hand, he wasn't crazy. He was reasonable. He was lenient. And for that leniency, his opponents said he was a seeker after smooth things. Did he take that as an insult or as a compliment? Maybe he reveled in that accusation. I might have taken it as a compliment. What's wrong with seeking after smooth things, if that's a reasonable thing to do? God's a reasonable God, right? Did Nicodemus walk about in deceit and falsehood like the Essenes said he did? Oh, poppycock. I could care less what those fanatics thought. Those silly Essenes walked about in deceit and falsehood too. Even more so than any of us Pharisees ever did. It's a good thing they ran off to live in those stupid caves and isolate themselves to death. Cavemen is what they are. I hope they stay there. And I don't care if they're stashing away scraps of paper with their stupid ideas on them. Even if someone finds them 2,000 years from now, it's not as if they're going to change the world or anything. Are we now able to understand Nicodemus a little better through all of the above-mentioned points and authorities? Do we have a sketch of him? Sketch is a good word because if we were artists, we would paint him. And that, in fact, is what one religious art professor can tell us about. The last person from the Pharisees book I'll mention. Angela LaDelfa is an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland Global Campus. In her paper, The Pharisees in Art, she says Nicodemus is the most frequent Pharisee depicted in figurative art. And not surprisingly, it's because of his special encounter with Jesus. She also tells us the great sculptor Michelangelo was particularly drawn to Nicodemus, and that Michelangelo's biographers have confirmed that his sculpture of Nicodemus taking Jesus down from the cross in Florence is the self-portrait of Michelangelo himself. Michelangelo saw himself as Nicodemus. Imagine that. She also relates that the great Baroque artist Caravaggio also had special interest in Nicodemus. In his famous painting of the Entombment of Christ, he puts Nicodemus as the lead figure in the foreground, holding the legs of the sagging horizontal Jesus. And of all the people depicted in the painting, the only one staring back at the viewer is Nicodemus. You should look at that painting, Caravaggio's Entombment of Christ. It's terribly poignant. He's hunched over, his arms around Jesus' dead legs, and his head is turned. And he's looking more at us, not apparently wanting to look at Jesus, awkwardly, clearly pausing in the critical task at hand, while the others around him are focused on that grave task at hand. His face has this blank look on it. It's not a face of grief or angst. It's a face of puzzlement. And he seems to be asking you for an answer. What am I doing here? How did I get into this? He wants you to answer his question. Please, how did I get into this? Tell me. You get the sense that the painting is not really about the entombment. It's about Nicodemus. It sort of gives me the chills. How does anyone get into Jesus? I don't know how to answer that. The ways are too many, too rich, too sublime. too complicated, too, well, everything. And that's why I like contemplating Nicodemus. He is, well, too everything. He's too rich. He's too much a ruler, too political. And he likes the praise of people too much, or at least one time he did. He was too skillful in the exact explication of the laws. His phylacteries and fringes were too broad. He liked seats of honor too much. He fasted too much, tithed on mint and cumin too much, bathed too much, exalted the Sabbath too much. He's too much a Pharisee. He seems to be like St. Paul, a blameless Pharisee. He feared his colleagues too much. He was too much at risk at being thrown out of the synagogue. And yet here he is at Jesus' burial, if not also at his crucifixion. And he's burying Jesus with too much spice and too much in public for all to see. And why? Because he loved Jesus too much. And let's not forget Nicodemus' very probable role at Jesus' trial that had gone all along that night before. As we mentioned in our series on the trial of Jesus, we have several strong clues that indicate that someone or others were there present at the trial before the Sanhedrin and were likely acting as Jesus' defense counsel that night. We know at least two things from the very meager gospel accounts. Number one, many witnesses were brought forth to testify against Jesus, and they couldn't agree. And number two, the trial lasted all night. Why couldn't the witnesses agree? Why did the trial last all night? If only because someone like Nicodemus and Arimathea were there objecting to evidence, pointing out inconsistencies of the witnesses, exonerating Jesus and forcing Joseph Caiaphas in a moment of exasperation to confront Jesus directly in open court and get a loose admission that could allow him to exclaim at dawn after a dismal failure of proof and exclaim, "What need we have we of further witnesses?" Yes, Nicodemus, likely Arimathea too, had a defense acquittal stolen out from under them. Nicodemus defended Jesus on procedural grounds at the Feast of Sukkot. Why wouldn't he have defended Jesus again here at Passover on both procedural and substantive grounds? And because he was not afraid to infuriate his colleagues over an arrest at that particular Feast of Booths, why would he not also be afraid to infuriate them again at a capital murder trial? And one more point about whether Nicodemus was at Calvary or not. Can't we fairly imagine this? What criminal defense lawyer who loses his case does not accompany his client to the electric chair, the gallows, or whatever place of execution it is? Are we really to think that Nicodemus, on hearing the judgment against his client as day was breaking, simply went home and had breakfast? And let's go back to that mystical and very personal prophecy Jesus gave directly to him, that he would see Jesus lifted up. A prophecy that yet again cuts against those who speculate Nicodemus was not actually at the scene of the crucifixion. Nicodemus saw Jesus lifted up, literally, physically. Jesus was the bronze serpent upon whom the Israelites looked upon and were cured of their otherwise lethal snake bite. Remember that figure well. All who looked upon the servant were saved. Well, all who looked upon that bronze serpent with faith were saved. The chief priests looked at Jesus lifted up, but they do not appear to have been saved. But why not Nicodemus? Why wouldn't he be saved after seeing Jesus lifted up at that particular time and place? He, being one of the very few people in all of human history, was privileged and tormented to witness. If he looked on Jesus with love, why would we not think he also looked on Jesus with faith? I think Father Brown is right. John specifically places Nicodemus at the burial of Jesus as a signal to other fearful believers that you too can be like Nicodemus. Historians like to say Nicodemus is an ambiguous character because we don't see evidence of final commitment. And that's true. We don't see that evidence directly. But we most certainly see the direction in which Nicodemus is headed, and we have no evidence he ever turned from that direction. The Catholic Church is always the most optimistic, always the most hopeful, always the most eager to see souls in heaven. It reflects that hope for Nicodemus too, and has placed him on its official martyrology, that is, its list of recognized saints. It places him with Joseph of Arimathea too, and they both share the same designated feast day, August 31st. Given what we know about him, why not? Nicodemus, Saint Nicodemus, pray for us.
Well, gatto Nicodemus, gatto Nicodemus, God, yes, it is. Gatto Nicodemus, man, you must be born again. Well, gatto Nicodemus, gatto Nicodemus, God, yes, it is. Gatto Nicodemus, man, you must be born again.
Well, there was a man of the Pharisees by the name of Nicodemus who did not believe. Same Nicodemus came to God by night, talking about religion from the human side. He brought along his silver, diamonds, and gold to buy his way to heaven and save his soul. But God told Nicodemus,
God told Nicodemus, God, yes, he did. He told Nicodemus, man, he must be born again. The bell God told Nicodemus, God told Nicodemus, God, yes, he did. He told Nicodemus, man, he must be born again.
Well, the same Nicodemus.